Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, to the NIDS View, your exclusive deterrence-focused podcast and where preserving peace and prosperity matters. I'm Jim Petrosky, president and co-founder and your host, and I'm joined by VP for Education and co-founder, Curtis McGiffin. Glad to have you here today, Curtis.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, today we're going to restart an effort by Curtis to conduct a monthly news roundup related to the deterrence landscape. And we'll likely keep this up in our program schedule for each month, where we'll highlight key developments from across defense, resilience, nuclear energy, strategic communications, and explore their implications for deterrence. And that's what we hope you can take away from this. And our goal is to provide you some timely insights and informed discussion.
Let me translate that for our listeners. The last Wednesday of every month, we're going to pick our favorite little news articles for the month, and we're going to quiz each other and see what we think. And so the little hint here for our audience is that neither one of us have previewed the other person's questions or news articles.
News article. Yeah, they're not questions. I didn't know, because if this is going to be like an exam, I could change this around. I have been a faculty member, and for those in the audience that had me in class, you know how I go. So here we go. No. That's a very, very good way to play this out. So we hope you look forward to it each month, and hope this is exciting and interesting, but also entertaining. And we hope you'll invite your friends, colleagues, neighbors, friends, and anyone else to listen to us at thinkdeterrence.com. So let's get started with a review of our headlines from October 2025 and unpack what it means. Go ahead, Curtis. Get us started.
All right. Well, I think there's a lot going on in the month of October 2025. So I'm going to start off with this one. And that is that it was an article out from the Associated Press that says that the Kremlin says its test of a nuclear powered missile reflects security concerns. And Jim, basically what this is Russia claims to have successfully tested, finally, its nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed cruise missile. They call it, and my Russian isn't very good, but they call it the Burevestnik. We call it in the NATO code name the Skyfall. And this is a missile that was first presented in 2018 as a cartoon image in one of Putin's presentations to the Duma. And if you recall, back in 2019, there was a mysterious loss of five nuclear scientists in an accident.
Oops.
That can cause some concern. Some rumor is that they might have been working on this system. But anyway, the claim this month is that they actually made a successful flight of this thing, and that it the Skyfall apparently flew 8,700 miles in 15 hours. And Jim, you know I'm not a math guy. I'm a liberal arts weenie, and I can do the math and figure that was 580 miles per hour, ish.
Yeah.
So that's still subsonic. Not much faster than the Tomahawk land attack cruise missile, but of course much less range. They claim that this 8,700 miles is not its extended range, that it can go much farther, and that this is an example of just of how Putin's novel weapons are really being brought out in an effort to establish deterrence, coercion, and I guess set Russia out as a technological leader in this specific scientific arena. I know the U.S. sort of played around with this way back in the 60s, and the technology's better, and I'm hoping that's what you're going to comment on. But the idea here of this missile is to be able to fly this thing literally around the Earth and to, if you will, attack the United States from the southerly approaches, which we generally aren't expecting these missiles. So hopefully Golden Dome will account for these if they can ever really perfect them and thus mass produce them. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, thanks, Curtis. Yeah, now I have actually looked into this. When I was a faculty member at AFIT, we actually looked at the nuclear-powered power generated rocketry, and you're exactly right. It goes way back into the 60s, in which you use a nuclear, use a nuclear source in order to generate the power either by expulsion of radioactive materials or by using it to generate a high pressure gas to be able to do liftoff and flight. And that's less well known and had poor technology. The problem there's a lot of rationale to what you said there, in that we think, you know, most people think, oh, it's a nuclear aircraft, so therefore it's going to fly really, really, really fast. And actually, mm-hmm. what the objective is to have a low weight payload, so you can take off pretty much at any time. From just about any location, so you don't need because you have a low mass missile, so you can go from anywhere. You can take off from a low mass, and then the other piece is the latency, which is really the problem. If you can orbit the Earth, you can imagine flying around the Earth at low orbit for many, many times, and then suddenly come out of orbit and launch your payload. That's really the fear here, because now the traditional way in which we monitor nuclear or any missile technology is we look at launch, we look at trajectory, we understand the ballistics fairly well, especially if they're going to go fly into, you know, into space and then fly back to Earth. We pretty much know where they're going to go as soon as they take off. But if we get some of these in space, and what's even worse, or low Earth orbit, or we get multiple ones of these into low Earth orbit, now we don't know who they come from, perhaps. I mean, you could lose track of them, maybe, in their orbits. If you have multiple ones, we don't know who's sending them. We don't know where they're going. We don't know their intended target. This becomes the problem with this nuclear-powered aircraft. Because, again, you have a long-term, it's always with nuclear. You have what people normally think of is, you know, nuclear weapons, short-term explosion. Yes, that's true. But the thing about nuclear power is you can have lots of energy for a long period of time. And so these aircraft can fly for long periods of time at a fairly low orbit because they have enough power to keep them in orbit instead of putting them up like a satellite and have them orbiting in that trajectory. So that really changes the way in which we have to look at this. And you're right. They can attack from any direction at any time once they're launched. And they can also, by the way, I'll use the Curtis McGiffin answer, they can communicate their intent by putting a couple in the air and saying, well, maybe we will, maybe we won't, and use it in a way that I'll talk about a little later on here.
Okay. Well, I think I think part of what you're describing is sort of this FOBS, this fractional mm-hmm. orbital bombardment capability. But these are more so cruise missiles that could even fly, I think, at much lower altitudes. Yes. Because they're almost, with the nuclear power, they are almost unlimited range. And so to your point, you could circle the Earth multiple times, but do it at 10,000
yes.
feet.
Yes, that's the
below
point.
Radar and these sorts of things. So this is extensive. I have two questions for you before we move on, since our listeners are have the blessing of hearing from an expert such as you. The first question would be is, if this thing is flying around, can its nuclear power, I know it doesn't have an exhaust, but its heat signature does. Or something be a way of which it could be tracked and detected? And the second question I have is, if this cruise missile were to do an impact, would the nuclear fuel make the impact or the detonation of the warhead even worse?
So let me hit both of these. So first of all, regarding signatures, as some of our audience may or may not know, much of our space assets are oriented on infrared signatures that come from the temperature signal that comes from a rocket's exhaust. And so we tune that to both look through the atmosphere and see a specific signature that is different from everything else on the ground. Because you're looking at the ground and everything looks the same, it just blends in, it camouflages itself. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we design our detectors in space to pick up on signatures in wavelengths that are specific to that rocket temperature signature. Okay, these are going to have a different rocket signature, okay, different temperature signal. They also do have an exhaust. That exhaust, especially if they're using the particle expulsion, so you're kicking out low energy high energy particles, but they are decaying, so they will leave a radioactive signal as well. But you'd have to be there, normally an alpha mm-hmm. particle. So you got to be within a couple, microns or millimeters to see it. So you don't have that kind of a signature. So you lose that signature coming out of the back. You don't have a burning exhaust. That's a problem. Right. Okay. So tracking becomes the problem. The other side of this is that you do have an alpha emission, a radioactive material that, of course, is providing with your propulsion. So when you crash this rocket, I call it crashing, when this rocket hits the ground, however we call it, and detonates on its target, that material becomes part of the mix. Will it become part of the, quote, nuclear detonation? No, but it will become part of the material cleanup and the hazards that are associated with that detonation. So even if you put a conventional weapon on the end of this rocket, you still have some of the effects that you would have from a nuclear weapon in terms of radioactive materials, cleanup, maintenance, hazards to human beings, hazards to clean up of that mess there. So they both add to that. Now, rockets do that too. Think of a hydrazine. Hydrazine is caustic. So if you had a rocket crash with hydrazine, it also is a chemical caustic material. So you have some similar, but radioactive becomes mm-hmm. different and can be persistent, because you want to build these rockets, they have a persistent, radioactive signal.
Great. Thank you very much. And just as sort of a parting thought on this is that this particular weapon system is not affected by the New START Treaty. It's not defined by the New START Treaty. It is essentially an intercontinental cruise missile, or maybe even what I might coin a phrase today, Jim, is a multi-continental cruise missile system, because it might cross multiple continents in order to get to where you might want it to detonate.
So I will gonna try to one up you here, Curtis, since we don't practice these ahead of time. This is what the fun of doing this podcast this way is. I would call it a global missile,
or a global that's a good missile. One too. Yeah, absolutely,
a global effect missile, a GEF.
So definitely, if this missile were to be perfected, it would have some deterrent effect. It's also extremely coercive, and would definitely be a first strike capability in this strategist's opinion. All right. We'll put that one away. Over to you, Jim.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. And so I'm going to take a completely different bent here from what we normally do, and I'm going to talk about an article that came out in FedTech. Magazine. I read a lot into Fed Tech because I'm into tech and I like it. And I always like relating things that are common to the average citizen and saying, why does that matter from a national security standpoint? And this article is called 5G is reshaping federal operations for a new era of secure, connected government. And the article is listing the advantages of 5G networks in strengthening our infrastructure and securing our communications. Many people may or may not have thought about this, but secure communications are essential to our nuclear command and control structure. Secure communications, of course, think about launching nuclear weapons. We've all watched the old movies from the 1970s where a couple high school students, break into the system and launch a nuclear weapon, whatever that silly movie was.
War Games.
But, that's it. War Games. So we've all heard of that. But the 5G, because we have much more bandwidth, much more information travel, we can make it more secure. And the other piece of this that's really interesting is that it allows us, because we have these 5G capability, allows us to have what are called smart military installations. And believe me, if you've been on a military installation, smart is normally not the way that we depict these. But these are smart military installations that allow us to change very rapidly the way in which operations are done from a communication standpoint, from a logistics standpoint, from an operational standpoint. And the other piece that really makes this work well is the fact that it can be remotely operated and even operate multiple, on a single network, operate multiple operational systems. So you can look at energy transfer, operational, maybe drone control, maybe also interacting with your defense mechanisms, and be able to transfer that information quickly rather than going through normal networks. The third thing that I like about this, and of course, if you heard last week's podcast, that I recommend that you do because we talked about resilience, is what it allows us to do that Curtis and I talked about is disperse your military operations because you can communicate over large bands, over broad distances in multiple ways. And so what ends up happening is you can have remote stations that are networked together but far apart. And then lastly, from a resilience standpoint, and why this 5G really helps out, is you don't have wires. So if you had a nuclear detonation between one military installation and another, you don't have wires and telephone poles and everything else to knock down, or you have a remote mobile station that can move in and fill that place rather quickly. So you imagine an EMP, you put a mobile station, you put it in a Faraday cage, underground or some other place where it's protected, a nuclear weapon is detonated. After it's detonated, all that problem goes away of the EMP, et cetera, because it's instantaneous. You pull it out of the shed, you park it in there, and instantly your communication's back. You've lost no control, you're ready for your second strike, and you're able to take back the war fighting, which is why the adversaries will say, I'm not sure to do this today. So that's what I read about this. I thought that was really a cool way to look at 5G, which all of us want in our cell phones so we can look at more cat videos. Curtis, what do you think?
Well, let me say, anybody who's been on a military installation, that is where you get the worst cell phone coverage, right? Because there's so many emitters and this and that, that usually it's the hardest place to get access to the internet or do anything through your phone, short of just the standard phone calls and texts. But I am a big fan of anything that we could do that is wireless. And to all due respect to our space brothers and sisters out there, I'm just also a big fan of anything that can carry us through once, you know, in a day without space, however that could happen, right? Whether it's inevitable or not. So, but the point here is that anytime we can do that, that's great. And you mentioned drone control in this. You know, this is how the Ukrainians flew this massive drone attack against the Russian Strategic Air Force when they attacked all the bombers. I don't know, past summer maybe. They didn't use satellites to control the drones. They used the Russian cell phone service, which goes to the point that this 5G has to be, you know, invulnerable to being hacked or somehow used for nefarious means, and that's always a challenge. But when you're looking at these abilities to talk in some sort of encrypted manner, to be able to have high data rate communications, to do video communications and these things, 5G is pretty good at that. I think the biggest challenge or obstacle, Jim, and is probably would have been appropriate in this federal article, is getting the feds to allow policies to do this.
Yeah, you know, the policy piece is not there, but you're exactly right, especially, you know, for all of us that have been in the military, you know, every time they, you know, put a computer on your desk, the best security you have is to unplug it and throw it in the trash can, because otherwise the security gets in your way.
Yeah, well, definitely. So, yeah, all for it, and I think wireless is the way to go. And there are lots of other alternative ways to communicate as I think things progress. 6G and 7G are right around the corner. 7G will likely be space-based. So we'll see how this continues to transform itself. But it would be very nice to see that we could get more wireless, as I think we mentioned in that previous podcast. So we don't have much copper anymore. Phone lines don't really exist anymore. If you have a hand phone in your home, it's probably some sort of VoIP system, and it's still using the internet and some sort of coaxial mechanism. So anyway, okay,
well, good,
well, great.
Chris, your turn. You
all
get
right,
to
my
go
turn.
For your next
we're
going to
keep going. Hey, we're moving on. So the next article I want to do is again here. It came out late October, and so for our listeners, this is probably still pretty fresh. You know, we know that the Department of War has been waging, well, in President Trump's words, war on these drug cartels, particularly those associated with Venezuela. And we have been providing, we've been conducting some kinetic strikes on their modes of transportation at sea. And this has caused some issues for some folks here in within the country politically, but that's not what I want to get to. What I want to get to with this is this article that came out in Defense News and said by Linus Haller. It says, heavy Russian cargo plane lands in Caracas amid U.S.-Venezuela tensions. This came out on October 28th. And that a Russian transport aircraft carrying what they believe are members of the Wagner mercenary group. We're all familiar with the, with the very famous Wagner military group, landed in the Venezuelan capital over the previous weekend, signaling heightened Russian interest in the Latin American country. And so what we're now starting to see is that despite Putin being besieged in this Ukrainian crisis, he is still interested in screwing around in Latin America here, and what we are seeing now is the beginning, what I think is the beginning, of Russian pushback for their ally Venezuela, you know, we can only speculate why Wagner shows up first, but I would guess that there is great potential for more things to be showing up. In that circumstance, and one of the things is that there's a history of this. So this past summer, the Russians sent one of their brand new Yazan class guided missile submarines, a nuclear submarine that can carry nuclear armed cruise missiles, sent it into Havana. This was a big deal. You're floating around in the Caribbean Sea in our back door, if you will, and they are out there doing their thing. There was a companion article here that I want to play on as well that came out in Military Watch magazine. Will Russia's Tu-160 bombers soon return to guard Venezuela? So the speculation by this author, it's no author, it's the magazine staff itself. The speculation is that Putin may send the White Swan, the big swing wing Tu-160 bombers back to Venezuela. He has done this three times: September of 2008, November of 2013, and again in December of 2018 during the first Trump administration. Putin deployed this potentially nuclear armed bomber to Venezuela to kind of show us that they can do it. And so now we've not been taking these things, I think politically very seriously. But you know, we had an entire Cuban Missile Crisis occur in 1960.
October, no less. So
yeah, exactly. Around this time frame in the early 1960s, I believe 62, I believe.
1962, a month before I was born, by the way.
Yeah, there you go. Well, okay. And so what we see here is sort of submarines showing up in Cuba, bombers showing up in Venezuela, while we are trying to conduct counter drug operations and getting after other authoritarian dictators that have become friendly with the Putin administration. So I look to see this as something that we need to be paying attention to. This may be an activity akin to a Cold War-like move, where we now see these sort of standoffs in different regions of the world, and Latin America may be the next one on the list as we wage war against narcotics, deadly narcotics that, by the way, have been killing 100,000 Americans a year. In 1 year, we lose more Americans to these narco traffickers than we have in all of the combat operations since World War II. That's how many deaths. It's a lot. It's a big number when you think about that.
That's breathtaking. I mean, really. And we have to put it in context to what's that mm-hmm. it is, unlike war, which sometimes is necessary. I mean, we really have to look at wars being necessary. We look at World War II. This is an unnecessary loss. I mean, it's a, you know, we could stop it. At least at the borders, or slow it down a lot. I'm not sure you can ever stop it. It's like homicide. We make a law against it. We can't stop it. But we can sure slow it down a lot.
Well, a couple of years ago, I put out an article that said that we need to start looking at the fentanyl's problem with and its association with the Mexican cartels in China as being a national security problem, not a law enforcement problem.
Yeah.
That was during the deep inside the Biden administration. And now here today, we see that it has become a national security problem. So no matter how our listeners may view this, I think this is where this problem has manifested into. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so I'll take a couple different views. One, I don't think this is new. As you said, Cuban Missile Crisis 1962. I think Russia has always had operatives in South America because they can get in. Putin likes to be an agitator. He likes to agitate because it gives him leverage. And so I see that as a big part of this. I'm not sure, again, I'm not an insider view, and maybe your article talks about this, but I'm not sure what Russia's primary, direct advantage in the drug business in Latin America is. I think it's more, China than it is Russia. But I do think as an agitator, it provides him leverage. It provides him an opportunity to communicate with us that he means business and he'll support his friends and allies no matter what they're doing. So I see that as a big communication from a deterrence standpoint. But then the flip side of that is that we are doing something to stop this existential threat, in my opinion, and I'm clearly aligned with you, this existential threat to our citizens by this drug traffic that takes advantage of the way that narcotics can see someone and eventually influence, their purchasing, et cetera. And it drains not only our national our national pride, it drains us from workforce, it drains us from funding, it drains us from law enforcement. There's a lot of things that agitation redirects. And from a deterrent standpoint, we can't focus, as you say, we can't focus. Imagine all those dollars that we're spending there we could put into our Sentinel program or other program that are not there. Well, it's really a real trade-off.
It's really about attacking the fabric of society, of American society, and ruining generations of American youth in many ways. If you just read the book Unrestricted Warfare the Chinese book came out in 1999, it'll clue you in on this.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. My last point is, though, and maybe tongue-in-cheek, maybe not so much tongue-in-cheek, is our military is getting an opportunity to do some real live training and exercise their capabilities in very real and valuable ways. I was an Army engineer, and we used to build roads at Fort Belvoir. Back in the day, we used to build roads and such on military installations, and Congress passed some sort of bill where we had to contract that out. So we trained on Fort Belvoir by building a road and then ripping it up and building a new road. Well, here they are actually using their capabilities for something that provides good to the United States. And I think our citizens, I think people need to see that that's happening. The legal issues, I think you will always have those legal issues. And there is, I understand the issue, but I also understand that we need to look at this as a war. And we need to look at who's killing whom in the end. Yeah, we may be taking out a few boats and a few narco-terrorists, but look at how many of our citizens are dying at their hands. So I'm willing to weigh that out. I'm just saying, I always look at things from two sides. I can understand a little bit of it, but I'm not necessarily in agreement.
Well, I'll cap this off with, in deterrence, we always talk about how deterrence is about saving lives and maintaining peace and stability.
And
President Trump says that that every one of these boats destroyed saves 25,000 Americans.
Yep.
So I don't know where those numbers come from. I'm just repeating what the government is saying in that regard. I'm not discounting them or in any way. I think it could be saving a lot more, because of the crime that occurs, to pay for these things and all, and so forth. Something else that we're learning from this, Jim, is just you know, how much of our infrastructure we've lost. You know, I saw on as they were getting ready to deploy forces for this that there was across the chyron of one of the news channels that are very popular that many people watch. It said that they were having to reopen a closed Navy base in Puerto Rico. I think they're talking about Roosevelt Roads. And, you know, this is one of these things where we keep closing things thinking this world is safe now. It's happy. We don't need these bases anymore. And then all of a sudden, we do. And so these things matter. We have to think forward. Part of deterrence is being able to think forward. And now we have to start thinking about how we're going to deter the Russians in the Caribbean. Yeah, to you, Jim, for your article.
Sure. Well, once again, my final comment, just so you understand, I said I see their point. I don't agree with it, but I can at least see the discussion. It's worthwhile as a democratic republic to have these discussions and understand them, because I think it brings out the more salient point, as you said. You know, people are dying and we're building an infrastructure around that. Well, good. So I'm going to talk about something again, catching an article of interest of mine. I'll hold my more closely held one to Curtis for the end here. But across an article on Nuclear Newswire, which I also read, it's a product
Nuclear
of the American.
Wire.
Yeah, it's a product of the American Nuclear Society, and they do an update every month, and I read through that update. So I thought it'd be good for this. The industry update for October 2025. Their topics include recaps of many industry happenings, and just showing you talking through the titles. The one is the top one right now. Years ago, it wouldn't have been this Advanced Reactor Marketplace. Okay. The second one is business developments, contracts. Okay. And they are sort of the format of their news. But in that news article, I want to highlight the Advanced Reactor Marketplace, because I truly believe, and you've heard me on this podcast, I talk about the nuclear renaissance. And we are going through a nuclear energy renaissance where we're looking at nuclear energy in a completely different way. And I ask our audience to take a breath, back up, and say, we had a time in our country where we built nuclear reactors fairly quickly. We thought we would have a nuclear power. There was a time, look it up, it was called too cheap to meter, okay, where it costs more to come out and look at how much energy you used than to just let you have it for free and only charge industries that were using it.
What a great life that would be.
Yeah, and I understand there were some problems that we had. We had, with every new technology, you're going to learn. And we had reactors that were based upon pressurized water reactors primarily. They were what were called a Gen 2 or 3, I think, or Gen 3 reactors. Gen 3 reactors, in which we had industrial reactors. And they were designed primarily around large reactors to support large cities because we use large amounts of power. And the new concept, which is being brought out, and there's several articles here on strategic partnerships for building high temperature, small modular reactors using a new fuel or a fuel. It's been in development for a long time called TRISO fuel. Stand for, let me think. Got to remember, tri-structured isotropic. Okay, and you're going to go, Petrosky, you use lots of big words. Okay, older reactor fuel, Gen 3 reactors, you took the uranium, you stuck it inside of a stainless steel shell, okay, and inside that stainless steel shell, we kept the nuclear material inside there. But when you had a high temperature event because of an accident, loss of water, et cetera, the temperature, the high temperatures from the reactor would cause it to melt or break. And because it would break, we had a release of radioactivity. The TRISO fuel doesn't do that. It's already operating at a high temperature and can withstand the temperatures much beyond what the nuclear fuel would create. So an accident will not release the radioactive materials as was previously. The other issue is they are extremely safe, because when you lose in a high temperature water reactor, when you lose the water, you stop cooling the reactor fuel, and that's why it overheats. This reactor fuel is cooled by gases that remove the heat. So bottom line is these reactors are now getting online. And according to these articles from this industry update, okay, there's been over $5 billion in public and private investments. And we're starting to see new energy construction. There's a company, BWX, which is BWX Technologies. They aren't a sponsor of theirs, ours, but they could be if they call me. they have a new subsidiary called BWXT, which do advanced fuels. And what they do is they're commercializing the advanced fuels like TRISO. And what they're doing is they're taking those, they're building partnerships with companies so they can build small modular reactors that can fuel, say, a city or even a data center, something as small as that. Now, most of these fuel reactors, most of these new small modular reactors run on fuel for, again, 3 years. If you listened to me last week, the neat thing about nuclear power is you don't have to refuel it every day. So you aren't being driven by today's market. You know, Russia can't say, well, we're going to stop sending you oil if you're dependent on Russian oil that we never should be in the first place. Or you've got 3 years to solve your problem before you have to even refuel the reactor. And they're modular, and they're built into, they're testing at Idaho National Labs. We're taking these reactors and building them into microgrids that can add or subtract modules so that we can change these reactors fairly quickly. They're safe. They're self-modulating or self-regulating. So the more power you request for them, the more power they provide. The less power you ask for them, the less power they provide. It's called load following. And they do load following in this way. You have reactor hands off for operators, which also is a major issue. So this nuclear renaissance is happening. It's the first time I've seen, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I'm not going to mention all the companies unless one of them wants to, you know, support me. I'll mention you on our podcast, but there are 9 companies, 3 of them overseas, 4 of them overseas. I'm sorry. And one of them in Korea too, which I think South Korea and the United States, you know, with President Trump now in Asia and us making some deals with South Korea, is an excellent opportunity to build trade relationships over nuclear power. Now, before you start, Curtis, I want to just mention deterrence. Resilient energy is really important for deterrence because, once again, if we have a susceptible power grid, our adversaries can bully us into changing what we do by taking out our power if it's vulnerable. If we spread it out over many, many different reactors, over many, many different microgrids, over systems that don't require to be refueled every day, we then are more resilient, and therefore we can do that second strike. And of course, our adversaries say, well, that's too hard because you're going to rain terrible things on top of us if we attack you. So we won't do it today. We'll just sit at our houses and eat whatever the Russians eat. Was it borscht or whatever it's called? I don't get out much. Go ahead, Curtis.
Beet soup. Yeah. Well, you know, one thing I've learned from working with you, Jim, is that the longer, more convoluted the name is, the more I'm supposed to trust the material or the mechanism. So what do you call this? A TRISO fuel, which I think was a shorter version of another bigger word. So,
scientists are lazy. We come up with new names for things that are, you know, have larger, you know, larger
it's
ideas,
all
whatever.
Part of the discovery process. Yeah. It's okay. Look, I'm all for safer reactors. Again, our hopefully we're not boring our listeners too much because we did talk a lot about this in our previous podcast on the resiliency side. I think what is the challenge here, first of all, I agree with you. I think there is a nuclear renaissance globally. You know, France, lots of nukes. Even the Germans are realizing, oops, we may have shut down too many nukes, and we may need to turn them back on. We all know how
too
the
late.
Chinese
they,
think
they
about
demolished
nukes.
Them. Well, they demolished them all. What
they'll
stupid.
Have to pay to rebuild them, you know. And so because the renewable energies are just not. I guess they're just not enough or not able to generate enough on a consistent basis in order to be useful. And, of course, they do have much larger footprints than these SMRs, these small modular reactors. I am interested, though, in this idea, though. So I want to take a little naysayer side of this only to just to craft some discussion here as we close ourselves out, is that if I'm changing out the fuel every 3 to 5 years on my reactor that's fueling my building, you know, my data center or my town or my military base, what are we doing with all of that waste, and how do we get rid of that or reuse it or recycle it or whatever the case may be? How do I placate the naysayer who will say we're just trading one form of pollution for another? And how is this different, I guess, in theory, from my first article here with the Skyfall missile, the small modular nuclear-powered missile, right? We're talking small nuclear powers that do a submarine. Why don't we do small nuclear-powered destroyers now? We have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and nuclear-powered submarines, but we don't nuclear-power our smaller or mid-sized combat ships, for example. At what point do we get to the technology where we can start doing those things, and how does that play off on the missile? And can we see a point in time where there is a nuclear reactor that can power, say, a fighter jet or a bomber?
Well, we've looked into that in the past. So the nuclear-powered aircraft was studied right here in Dayton, Ohio. And actually, the building where I worked at AFIT and did much of my research was designed specifically around building a nuclear-powered aircraft. They also did studies on a Project Orion in which they were going to have a nuclear-powered city, which was launched into space with nuclear weapons. So, you know, scientists can really think outside the box, but I'm not sure that would be a great idea to launch, you know, a city with a large dome underneath it with, 50 nuclear bombs at a megaton each to put it in space. So all I'm saying is not all ideas are good, but they're interesting to think about. Let me go back to, first of all, your comment about the Navy. I don't know why. It's not a technology issue. We could build reactors, we could build reactors to do, power a destroyer, power my Bayliner outside if we wanted to. That's not the problem. So I don't know why we don't do it for smaller naval ships. So the technology is not necessarily the issue. Now you do have on a larger ship, because you have a reactor and because it is emitting neutrons, you do have to have some space in which you can have people not living in that space, constantly. So you do have to have a little bit more space for that reactor and for its safety around you. But I don't think that's as I'm not a Navy guy. I said the biggest I get is my, 20-foot Bayliner. So go beyond that. Your previous question was
the waste.
We're talking about the waste. So the waste issue. So I always like to talk about waste for energy this way. We burn tons and tons of coal, When we burn tons of coal, we have coal ash, and it has a lot of alpha emitters and heavy metals in them. And over your lifetime, there are multiple train loads of ash that are reflective of the energy that you've used in your entire lifetime. And if you go to nuclear power, because it's so energy dense, that in an average lifetime of a human being, there's about as much waste as you would put in a hockey puck. Okay, now you think about it. Which can you control the material, polluting everything else? A hockey puck or a train load full of stuff? How are you going to get rid of that train load full of alpha emitters that are the waste product of your coal plants, or all this waste that we're putting into the air? So every energy solution does have an energy issue. Now the other piece of this, though, in these small modular reactors, and the reason they've gone to this low assay uranium is it's very recyclable. And I know that President Carter said we're not going to recycle our fuel because you do have some plutonium that's created from it. But if we went into recycling our fuel, we would save about 2/3 of the waste from it. Okay. And then we used, reactor material waste that is converted to other materials. We're doing alchemy all the time. We're basically converting uranium to other things. We create gold. It's expensive, so you do that. But we create other materials that are radioactive in that process. But those materials get used. Cobalt gets used in manufacturing to do surveys. We We create some materials that are used for medical needs. We have the waste materials that are used for long-term alpha emitters are used in thermal reactors that are thermal generators that are used to power flashing lights in the ocean because they don't have to be refueled. So all of these things, we need to think about how to use this. And it, as it's decaying over time, becomes less radioactive. And over time, it decays back to a natural state. Everything wants to be just like me. It just wants to be in the lazy, no moving state. So it starts out moving, and over time, it gets back to its natural, stable state. That's why we have stable isotopes around us. So it is an issue. And but my view is it's more of a political issue.
Yeah.
Just like everything else, then it is a technology issue. And here in Ohio, we have the waste isolation plant. We separate things out. We've come a long way since the 1970s when people thought that, and it wasn't bad. Nuclear power wasn't bad then. It's even better now. I mean, this is just incredible. I haven't looked up, so I don't know about TRISO, but I believe it's also easier to separate the carbon and oxygen seal that's around the TRISO pellet. These are like little pellets. They look like dust. These little pellets that look like dust are carbon surrounding uranium. I believe they're easier to separate. So once you do have the reactor done, you can then clean them up and separate these out, and you don't create a lot of radioactive waste. Stainless steel becomes quite radioactive. The nickel around it becomes radioactive. All those other things. This material doesn't, so you have a much lower waste in these reactors. And I believe I've really taken up our time.
I think we're out of time.
Yeah, so that's only two articles.
I guess as long as you have more or less radiation than in a banana.
That's right. Yeah, here we go. So that's good. So, so this is only two articles, Curtis. Maybe we'll keep it shorter next time. Audience, you're the ones to dictate. We are at your beck and call as long as it is deterrence related. I will end us out this way. Thank you, listeners, for listening to these great articles. Curtis, I can't tell you, you made me think about these things in a way I didn't think about up front. I'm going to go back and look at them again because I always like the challenge of understanding.
And I learned some new words today, so thank you.
Yeah, to our donors, thank you for supporting us. We need your support to be able to keep these podcasts out there. Again, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell everyone that you know to listen to us. This has been a great opportunity for us to share with you. And as always, we ask you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501(c)(3) organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View. NIDS Podcasting Network.